Reel 2. Yes, if you could tell me, if possible, sort of in sequence, as much as you can remember, of the day, which I think was it July the
2nd? July the 2nd, roughly.
Where you were when it happened?
Well, I was under the table, sleeping, actually. Well, I was awake, I think, but I was still laying down there. And we heard this terrific explosion. And somebody actually said later on they saw the U-boat. I don't believe them anyway. I'm afraid not. I don't think the U-boat surfaced at all, because I was out very, very quickly on deck. I was bound matter of maybe 10, 15 seconds to see what happened. And I didn't see anything, so... But somebody said he saw it. And there was a friend next door, Vic Tolaini, there. And we said, well, we've been hit all right, because the boat was already listing a little. And we said, well, we've got to get off somewhere. And we went down one deck and looked and thought, well, you can't get in here. People were trying to lower the lifeboats, but nobody knew anything about it. They were lowering one side only, and of course the lifeboat would crash against the side of the ship, you see. The only ones who knew about it were Germans. That is why, going a little ahead, there were more Italians dead than the Germans. Because the Germans were all young, and they were all people from merchant ships, and they knew exactly what to do in case of emergency. Whereas the Italians, I say, were used to kitchens and restaurants. They had no idea whatsoever what to do on board. Absolutely nothing, including myself. And so we said, well, I've got to jump. We have to get in somehow to my friend Vic. And I had my raincoat on my arm. This is quite funny. So I couldn't have been panicky, although I'm a little nervous at times. And I'd bought this raincoat a few weeks before, and things were rather expensive. We didn't have much money, and I had it over my arm and went on deck, and we said, well, we have to jump in here. After a while, I said to my friend, I said, hang on a minute. He said, where are you going? I said, I'm going downstairs to where we were sleeping. And I got my raincoat and folded it up and put it underneath where I was sleeping as a pillow again, and then went upstairs, and then we had to jump in, which was a silly thing to do, wasting, say, 3 or 4 minutes, you know. But the idea was that such a lot of shipping had been torpedoed, because the war had been going on for nearly 9 months. But the ships hadn't all sunk. So I thought, well, if it doesn't sink, I have my raincoat, which was rather silly, I must say. And then, of course, as the boat listed a lot and it wasn't very high, we thought, well, we've got to jump in here. We saw a raft, and we jumped in and hung on to the side for hours and hours, you know, until we were picked up in a lifeboat, I think about 6 or 7 hours, I think. And then pulled in a lifeboat until the Canadian destroyer came, the St. Laurent, known as the H-83.
When you jumped into the water, you know, with your pal, was that a very, you know, could you swim?
I can't swim a stroke.
I wonder how you felt.
That was the only chance, you know. It's either, you know, have to do it. And as it wasn't really that much of a jump, and there was this raft with the ropes hanging at the side, as you well know, I thought, well, this is the only thing to do. We haven't any chance to do anything else. And then, later on, I found out that a friend of mine, Carlo Delsi, who was champion swimmer of Highgate Ponds, died. I didn't see him in the morning, so I really don't know, but I can only think that he dived in, as he was such a good diver, and hit some wreckage, or hit a raft, or hit, as I say, any wreckage, that everything was being thrown overboard. That's the only thing I can think of, because he was a champion swimmer.
How did you fare when you hit the water?
Well, I didn't go down very deep, because I say that jump wasn't that high. The boat was listing such a lot. And just thank God that I grabbed hold of the rope at the side and stayed there. And
you didn't get on the raft?
No, didn't get on the raft, no. On the raft was the carpenter belonging to the Arundora Tiles, Scotsman. He was fantastic. He kept us going and keep it up, boys, and all the time for hours and hours. But there was a lot of people next to me, well, they were Italian. They were all Italians on our side. There weren't any Germans, who really couldn't stand it and just sort of slipped their arm out of the rope and just floated away. Said, I can't stand it anymore, non ne posso più. And I couldn't understand why they did this, because myself, I was saying, I have to die before I let go of this rope. That was my mind was working that way, which I did until they sort of picked me up. And then I was so exhausted that when I was in a lifeboat, I sort of half passed out, and they were throwing people overboard as they were dying from the lifeboats, you know, one or two maybe, and they wanted to throw me overboard. That actually brought me to life very quickly. Because as they tried to push me, I said, I'm not dead. And that got me quite... It was a very good shock therapy. So until the Canadian destroyer came and picked us up a few hours after.
How did you were just sort of in the water, hanging on?
That's right, in the water, hanging on to the side rope.
How many hours were you doing that?
Well, I think it was about... must have been about 6:30 or so, or say 7 o'clock, till about midday, I should think, up there. And then in the lifeboat for another 3 hours. I think we got on the St. Lawrence. We were the last boat to be picked up about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Got there.
What sort of effect does it have on you? You know, being
no effect whatsoever.
Being in the water, you know, at the time. Do you get cramped?
Well, yes, it was, considering it was July 2nd, it was quite cold. Because, of course, we had gone a little north. It was 170 miles northwest of Ireland. So we were going north, you know, zigzagging. And it was cold, but you see, I was fully clothed. Not that it helped at the time, because I jumped in. A lot of them weren't. And once we got on the St. Lawrence, the destroyer, the Canadian destroyer that picked us up, there were so many people on there, and it was so warm downstairs that we couldn't stand it, Vic and I. And we stayed upstairs under the gun turret. And they brought us up some rum. They were marvellous, the sailors. They were really marvellous, and brought us blankets and that. And we stayed up there all night. You know, the gun turret was very hot. And when he brought us the rum, we said, what's the chances of being hit again? And he says, well, you don't have to worry if you're hit. You're sleeping on top of the gun magazine, the powder magazine, with all the ammunition, so you'll be blown to bits. So he says, don't worry about it, he said, which was quite funny. You know, we stayed there all night until they landed us at Greenock in Scotland there.
Going back, if you don't mind, Nicky, you know, to the water again, yeah. And the raft. You were saying about the carpenter on the raft.
Yes, Scotsman.
He was the only one, was he?
Only one on the raft, yes.
Yes, but would he have been in a sort of situation of control?
Well, he did, yes. You see, we couldn't have all got on the raft, I don't think, because, first of all, it was very slippery with the oil from the ship, from the Arundora Star. And I wasn't going to attempt it anyway because I couldn't swim. And I said, if I slip off. So nobody attempted to get on. He was sat in the middle and just kept speaking to us for hours and with a pipe in his mouth, unlit. And he was really marvellous. I would have liked to have met him after the war, you know, but...
Did you have exercises and things like that in the water?
No. It was just that... some lifeboats were going round and round trying to pick people up all the time, and of course there were so few lifeboats. First of all, they weren't sufficient for everybody for a start. Secondly, as the boat listed so quickly, the ones on the side that was facing upwards, put it that way, were useless. You couldn't let them down, you see. And on top of that, the ones on the side that you could let down, a lot of them were let down one side only, and they crashed against the side like matchboxes. So the lifeboats were very, very few for everybody. I mean, I don't know exactly how many people are on board, but it was quite a lot. You know, 700 odd Italians and about 500 Germans, and there was all the crew of the ship and also the guards. Goodness, I don't know how many hundreds there were. So for the crowd, of course, there wasn't enough boats anyway, normally. So we were very, very lucky indeed.
I was wondering also, you know, when the ship went down, which you explained earlier was very quick.
Yes,
like
very quick. 20-odd minutes, I think, yes. 23, I think, exactly.
Was there a risk of suction?
Well, it wasn't bad at all. It wasn't bad at all. Yes, I was surprised because all that goes through your mind, you know, get away from the ship as far as possible because when it goes down, it's going to suck you down. And it wasn't bad at all, from not that I'd had any previous experience, but it just went up and there was such a lot of people still on board. There was just a sort of a groan from the people left on board as it went down, you know, and on the bridge there was the English captain of the ship, there was a German captain of the ship, and there was an Italian priest giving the benediction. And they all went down with loads of people because the barbed wire that was around the guns, because there were two guns, one fore and one aft, and sort of drew everybody down as it went down, you know, the guns came down and everything.
Did you see that?
Yes, saw that from, I think, 150 yards away. I should think it was a terrible sight to see it going down, but it wasn't. It wasn't such a lot of suction, as I say. You know, it went down slowly and just disappeared. And then there's deathly silence afterwards, you know, from every all about lifeboats, or just a deathly silence after that, until the boilers exploded. That wasn't much anyway, underwater. And the oil came up and that sort of thing, which was rather good. It kept you warm, really.
How about bodies? You know, were there many bodies? All
bodies floating all over the place, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. As I say, we lost over 530 Italians, I think, alone out to. Actually, the exact number was 252, I believe, and 52 went to hospital and finally ended up at the Isle of Man. But the 200 of us who were sent to Australia from the Arundora Star were the exact 200. Which we, as I say, landed at Greenock, and we thought, well, we'll never be put on a ship again, not to go away, you know, to go abroad. And after, I think it was 10 days, we were again put on. Most of us, of course, weren't properly clothed. Some didn't even have trousers. Quite a lot of them didn't have trousers. And when we saw this big ship again, we could hardly believe it, that they would send us away again, you know, in a far, far, far away somewhere. There again, we didn't know where we were going. So,
What happened to your father?
My father was with me all the time. He was saved. He was saved, but independently. Because we had said the night before, because this doctor spoke to the captain, Dr. Zedzi, the captain had said, we know we are a sitting target. We're all alone. And so I'd said to my father, if anything happens, you go for yourself, I go for myself. And that's exactly what happened. I didn't go chasing around for him at all. Because it was a case of two brothers, the Cardosi brothers, Valesco and Nello, that when the boat was sinking, I forget which one I met first, Valesco, Vic and I, we met them, and they said, have you seen my brother, Nello? And we said, we haven't seen him, but jump in, because it's going down, you know, it's going down fast. And he said, no, I must find my brother. And he went, and then we went on another deck to see where we would have to jump in. And we met this other brother, and he said, have you seen my brother? I said, yes, he was downstairs, but jump in. No, he said, I have to find him, and they both died, looking for each other, and, well, it's fate. But, you know, looking for each other and wasting time like that. And then there was a father and son, that the son wouldn't leave the father, the Giannotti, father and son. they wouldn't leave the father, he wouldn't leave his father because he was badly cut. Because when the explosion came, it was a beautiful ship, one of the best pre-war cruise ships in the world, it was. White and gold, supposed to have been beautiful. And it was all mirrors on the lounge, and of course they all went to bits and a lot of people were cut. So he wouldn't leave his father, who was badly cut, and he just stayed on. There was nothing wrong with the son at all, but he just wouldn't leave his father. So he went down as well. And there were such a lot of different cases like that. But there is a strange case of two men, I forget their name now, I think they were Rabaiotis from Wales, who when we got to Australia, they came up to us and they said, "You saved our lives on the Arandora." And I said, "I'm sorry, you've got the wrong person. I didn't save anybody. I just tried to save myself, said I couldn't swim." And I said, you have the wrong persons, you know. And Vic said, "Well, I didn't do anything, you know, we just looked after ourselves." And he explained it. He said, when we were at Bury, the Dead End Kids, we were a little noisy at night, as youngsters. We were making the best of things. And the older people wanted to sleep. And we had some candles. And we used to joke about and have these candles on, because no electric light. And they kept on shouting out, "Why don't you keep quiet, you little so-and-sos?" And we didn't take any notice as youngsters. They're worse now, but... And, of course, about the third night, we had these candles on, and they came over and snatched the candles away and stopped us, you know, where we're still speaking in the dark, but they took the candles away. And then they put it in their pocket. When they were on the Arandora, they happened to be downstairs in the cabin. And when the explosion came, the lights went out. Couldn't find their way. They took out these candles and came up on deck, and they were both saved through our candles. That's why he said, "You saved our lives," which we didn't know anything about. So it's fate again, you know, just for those two little bits of candle. Two men saved their lives, two brothers, Rabaiotti brothers from Wales. So that was it.
You explained earlier the advantages the Germans had over the Italians.
Yes, well, they had the advantage of having been torpedoed by a British submarine. They knew exactly what to do. First of all, they were young in comparison to the Italian community. And then they were seamen, and they knew exactly the routine. And, of course, there was more of them saved than the Italians, but it was only because of that. It wasn't because of any pushing or shoving or anything like that. There most probably was individual panic, I don't disagree. But I didn't see any strong panic, as the papers put on the following day, on July the 3rd. There was fighting between the Italians and the Germans. I personally did not see that. I saw some individual panic and some petrified panic, put it that way, of a friend of mine, a great friend of mine, who lived in just off Shaftesbury Avenue, Italo Traversa, was only 21, who was on the bridge. Italo Traversa was a friend of mine for years. I'm still in touch with his sisters now at the moment. Next week I'll be in touch with his sisters who live in the next village there. But he was on the bridge with a sort of scarf round his neck with a ring and just travelled up and down, and he just wouldn't jump. I said, "Jump, Italo," you know, because it was only, say, twice this height. That's probably, he just wouldn't jump, and he went down with the ship. He was sort of, as I say, petrified, is the word, that he couldn't move.
Are there any more sort of memorable anecdotes?
Not on the boat. No, I can't think of. No, we met this father and son and the two brothers. There was nothing in my incident of the raincoat. The time was so short.
Mm. This business of getting from the lifeboat, you were saying you were taken from the raft into a lifeboat.
Yes.
When you had really had enough.
Just pulled in, yes.
Yes. And then getting on the St. Lawrence.
Oh, yes.
I suppose that wasn't so easy, Nicky, was it?
No, but there's all these rope ladders hanging at the side, you know, and the sailors were marvellous, no doubt about it. They didn't care who you were or anything like that, you know. They were very good then. We went downstairs, but it was so stuffy for me. I thought, well, I can't stay down here, you know. You can imagine with their crew, I don't know how many crew there are on a destroyer, but with all those people that were saved, which was probably 500 or 600 extra people on board, you can imagine how crammed then we were, you know.
And your reception when you arrived back at Greenock, you know, getting off the ship and being cared for, what was that like, the organisation?
Well, that was quite all right. They took us to a warehouse, something there where we were fed and that. And actually, I could have been a free man, not only myself, but several others, because there was a little alleyway, about only as wide as this, that led us to one of the main roads. And I wanted to go to the toilet, and I went out and I found myself in the main road and could have walked out, you know. I ran back in, not knowing, of course, not there. But there wasn't that sort of guards could be. There were no guards there. I mean, we just walked out to the toilet and that sort of thing. And then, of course, they took our names because that was the first they knew of the survivors, you know, to have taken names. And the Red Cross came and Salvation Army came, gave us toothbrushes and whatnot. And we stayed, I forget how long we stayed there, I'm afraid my memory's not so good, when they took us down to Arrow Park, down to Birkenhead again.
What was that like? You know,
well, Arrow Park were all tents where a lot of the people from Dunkirk had been, French soldiers had been in there, and then after that, I think we only stayed one night there, and then we were taken to a Mason Street in Liverpool, a drill hall, which was actually used for coal. There was piles of coal there, and we stayed there for just a day or two, and when we were put on the Dunera again.
Did you wonder whether or not they would try to send you deport you again?
Well,
about it.
I don't think anybody thought they would send us far away again. We really thought that this time we would go to the Isle of Man. Really thought that. I don't think there was one person who thought they would put us on the high seas again. Only until we walked down to the docks from this drill hall that we saw this Dunera ship, which was not as big as the Arandora, but I think it was 12,000, which was a fairly big ship. And we thought, oh my God, we're going away again, you know, going far away again, because this is not a usual ship that goes to the Isle of Man. And then, of course, once we got on there, it was all guesswork. I mean, as I say, a lot of people were saying we're going north, we're going south, and we were actually going up and down to avoid U-boats. So that's why it took us 55 days to get to Australia. Not there. So we were torpedoed again, but the torpedo didn't go off. It hit the side, apparently. And we saw the dent when we got off. But had it gone off then, full on, I wouldn't be here now, of course. Not there.
But when you went on the Dunera, were all the survivors from the Arandora Star together?
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
The Germans and the Italians?
The Germans were below our deck. We were all on one deck, actually. And the Germans were below us there. But they were all the survivors of there. But, of course, there was a lot of Jewish refugees who had not been on the Arandora who were put on. They were the biggest number, actually.
What did you yourself have, you know, when you went on the Dunera? Because presumably you lost all your possessions.
Didn't have anything. Didn't have anything at all. None of the Italians had anything. Well, no, there were one or two, such as Victor Laini, because he had got one of the guards to phone his brother in London, and his brother had come up with his cousin and brought him a suitcase. with some things because he didn't have any shoes and didn't have any jacket. So his brother had bought him a suitcase which was taken off of him before going on the Dunera. So he, and none of the Italians had anything at all left up there because we'd been fished out of the water 10 days previously. So there was nothing to take, really, in that way.
Were you searched there, you know, when you went
Yes,
on?
We were searched, yes, we completely searched. And there were a few incidents that weren't very nice.
Could you tell me about those, Nicky?
Well, I was all right. There was a friend of mine, Luigi Beschizza, who lost his hunter watch, which he praised so much, and he took out, I think, a 2-shilling piece and said, "Here you are, take this as well, and you've taken everything else, take this as well." You know, he's a saucy fellow. He still is, actually. We're still great friends there. And, of course, the guard told him to pick it up, and he wouldn't pick it up. He says, "Well, you've taken everything else, take this as well." So they battered him with a rifle. So he had, I said, "Pick it up." And he says, "Silly, what can you do, you know?" But the ones who really lost everything were the Jewish refugees from Nazi, because they had beautiful, as I say, you're too young, but pre-war, everybody who could had thick leather suitcases. It was so thick, they weighed a ton before you put anything inside them, you know, and you used to travel by train, and everybody had these with the initial on, and that, and they had those beautiful suitcases with all beautiful things inside. And I was the one that, when we were on the Dunera, the second day out, the sergeant came in and said, "You, you, you, and you," and I was one of the yous. And I thought, "Oh my God, this is it. This is our lot, you know." We were at that time a little down in morale, obviously. And they were upstairs, and they just ripped all these beautiful suitcases open with their bayonets and told us to throw them overboard. Beautiful, piles and piles of these beautiful suitcases. And I thought, "You must be idiots. Why don't you keep this stuff? Silk pyjamas, silk dressing gowns and all that." Apparently the Jewish community had given them all these things when they ran away from the Nazis. And they had the most beautiful things, and they made us throw them all in the sea. And I could see a trail of them along there, and I thought, "Well, that's nice for a U-boat. They'll follow us up," which they did. But they threw them all away. I could never understand it. Why on earth did they do that? Why not keep it? If they wanted to take it, they were at liberty to do so.
Did they keep any of the things, though, as far as you could see?
As far as I could see, we threw them all overboard. Some of ours managed to, I was too scared to grab hold of something, you know, but Marco Gazzi, who's still in Australia, he should have come over for Sunday. He was a cheeky guy, and he managed to get a pair of silk pyjamas for himself. But I was too afraid of what might happen, and I didn't take anything at all. I just threw them all overboard, and I don't know, hundreds of these cases. Could never understand that. Still to this day, why they threw the things overboard. And that was it, you know. And of course, we had 55 days, and we stopped for water at Takoradi, the first place in northwest Africa, and then stopped at Freetown, and we thought, "Well, we get off here," but we didn't. And then we thought, "Well, where are we going now?" You know, and we all thought the next place would be the island of Saint Helena, where Napoleon was, because we thought that's an ideal place, you know, and we're out of the way from everybody. And we didn't stop there. So we thought, "Well, I don't know where we're going." Then we stopped at Cape Town because we could see the Table Mountain. And we thought, "Oh, this is it, boys." You know, never thought for Australia, obviously. And no, they didn't get off there either. So I thought, "Where on earth are we going?" And then we travelled for, I think, 7 or 8 days or something. And then we stopped at Perth, at Fremantle. Perth in Australia said, "Oh, well, we can't go any further away than this." We still didn't get off. So we thought, "Mike, where are we going? We're going to be on the high seas for the rest of the war, you know." And then we did the Australian bite, I think it's 5 or 6 days, and we stopped at Melbourne. And we thought, well, this has got to be it. And we did get off there. The Italians got off there. Then it went on to Sydney, and the Jews got off at Sydney. But we got off there, 200 of us. September 3rd, 1940.